I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Wayne Cobb-Braithwaite saw incredible success following the release of her debut novel, My Sister, the Serial Killer. She's back with another story set in Lagos, Nigeria. Cursed Daughters follows a line of women who believe they're cursed when it comes to finding lasting love. And when a newborn baby closely resembles her aunt who tragically died young, the women in the family cannot help but speculate that she is her aunt reincarnated and doomed to the same fate. I spoke with Oyinka Braithwaite about Cursed Daughters, and here's our conversation. Cursed Daughters is your second novel. Would you set it up for us?
Yeah, sure. So imagine a beautiful, dark-skinned, confident young woman who's living in an intimate village, and a man comes to this village and she decides she likes him. So she sneaks into his room one night and they have a passionate night together. And for him, you know, she leaves before he wakes up. So for him, it's a sort of fever dream. And he's about to leave the village when this crowd comes to him, and they basically accuse him of eating something and trying to leave without paying. And he says, "When did I eat something and not pay for him?" And they part like the Red Sea and reveal the woman he spent this night with. So basically, he's forced to marry her, which he does. Unfortunately, he already has a wife. And this wife he already has promptly curses the new wife, but she also curses her daughter, her daughter's daughter, and all the women that will come from her lineage. And the curse is that they will never be able to hold on to a man. They will love in vain. They will labor for a man's attention and love. And, you know, they will pretty much always fail. And the story is sort of about this family of women who have to contend with this curse. And it focuses on the youngest three, Munife, who is dead at the start of the story. We know how, but not why. Ebu, who is working very hard to guarantee her daughter a different future. And Ini, who everyone thinks is a reincarnation of her dead aunt.
So I want to start before the novel even begins, in the pages before the novel, because you provide readers with the Falun Dafa family tree, and it looks mostly similar to a traditional family tree, but with some slight differences, and we're even provided a legend to help decipher what's going on here. So, you know, much like you just described, talk to me about this illustration.
Yeah, I got confused. I got confused at some point when I was writing this, because, you know, there are a lot of women to keep track of mostly. And then at some point I realized I actually had to simplify a little bit. So there was some editing that was done to the family tree in order to not confuse the reader, not confuse myself, and not confuse my editors. So I lost like one or two characters that had, you know, been in the family prior. And the person that caused the most drama in this family tree was Kemi, aka Grandma East. And it's because she's basically had, I think, three husbands, one baby daddy, and is looking for, you know, she's looking for additional husbands, but she's had many and she's had children from some of these marriages. So she caused the most drama for this family tree. But yes, it was a helpful tool for me in the writing process, and it was sort of a necessary inclusion in case the readers did at some point get a bit lost.
I liked the other visual kind of describing the family. At one point in the novel, the narrator remarks on the Falun Dafa family. The lines had been tangled for all of them a long time ago, and this was not the time to unpick the knots. So why is this family dynamic of entanglement or knottiness crucial in telling this particular story?
I think, for one, you know, it's a story about one woman's mistake, or, well, if you consider it a mistake, but one woman's error and how it affects every woman that comes after her. That's a massive, tragic legacy. This is a woman that many of them have never met. They've only heard about her. They've only been told. It's sort of like the family lore, but they're still bound by it. And it's not easy for them to separate themselves, to walk away from this legacy. They're all connected. They're all tangled up together. And these women that have come before, the women that we're following in the present, These women and their choices have also affected and continue to affect the women in the present. So it's their bond, their love, but also this legacy that they share keeps them connected and bound together.
The central conceit of the book, even in its title, is that the daughters in this family are cursed when it comes to love. And at one point early in the book, it reads, 12-year-old Ebu told 16-year-old Monifa that she didn't believe in curses. That's fine, said Monifa, but what if the curse believes in you? So in developing each of these women as characters in the story, how central was it for you to consider each woman's understanding of the curse or their sense of fate?
It was pretty much at the heart of the story. I think that for some belief and faith, I think, is a big part of what keeps the ending of the story going. And some of these women have, unquestionable faith in this curse. And it's, I say faith, they don't want the curse, but they don't doubt it. They don't doubt that it exists. They don't doubt that it's going to affect them. And then you have some of the women who maybe have heard of the curse, but have a looser relationship with it and are hoping that it won't come to pass or doubt that it will come to pass. And then there's some who have completely dismissed it and yet are still affected by it regardless. We're following three of the characters closely, but even the women that we don't follow closely, we sort of get a sense of what their relationship with the curse is and whether or not they believe it. And and I think I also believe that the readers will also have different relationships with the curse. You will come across readers who, based on their cultural background, might be more willing to believe the curse in its purest form, whereas some might be like, oh, this is a metaphor for generational trauma, or this is just self-fulfilling prophecy at work. And that's okay too. As far as I'm concerned, all those things ring true for this story.
The structure of the novel is another form of entanglement as we move back and forth in time to track different women in the family. How did you have to structure the story in your mind while writing it? I mean, you mentioned having the family tree there because you got confused as to who was what, but how did you keep track of the different time periods?
Initially, I wasn't writing it the way it's written now. Initially, I was writing them separately, and it was good for me because if I struggled in one timeline, I just go to the timeline where I was like, I think I know what's going on in this timeline, and I'll just move on to that timeline. And I thought that that was how the story was going to be, three separate chunks. Because in my mind, let's say you read Ebu's timeline in its complete form, and then you read Monifa or you read Eni, and you're like, oh, that's why that happened. Or that, it sort of, you would discover it like long after the fact why some things took place. But the flow wasn't working for me. And at some point, I thought, you know what, I think I need to kind of splice them together. And it was still like semi early stages. I hadn't finished the story completely, but I was pretty far gone and I started to splice it, and it was just working for me in that way. And I was like, okay, I think I've got something here. I think it's working. I think this is the way. And then just trying to figure out how to do it in such a way that didn't just pull the reader harshly out of it, out of the story, and out of what was going on, the way that kind of felt organic to the story as a whole. Took a little bit of figuring out, but it was fun to do.
Water, particularly the sea, has a malicious presence in the book, from drownings to potential drownings to water stains in a room. Talk to me about water as a symbol for death. You wrote, "The sea does not give up her prey so easily."
I really love, I think it's a personal, I have a very interesting relationship with water personally, because as far, I've like had at least like two near drowning experiences. And but I also like really love water and the idea of being, I'm a terrible swimmer, but just the idea of being a strong swimmer is really seductive to me, and how beautiful and how terrifying the ocean is, and how we don't really know what's down there. The whole thing, I think, is really fascinating. So I kind of played with that a little bit. And I had also, there was this spoken word poem that I had listened to a couple years ago called Swim by a Nigerian spoken word artist by the name of Titilope Shonuga. Such a beautiful, it was like a coming of age poem about womanhood, but also water, and it was really beautiful and it made a strong impression on me. So even though I haven't listened to it in years, I remember listening to it and thinking I'm gonna have to write about water. So I have had to thank for that as well.
It was really fascinating to get to follow a character who's trying to figure out if she's really herself or if she's just someone else reincarnated. Through that experience, she really questions whether she has free will or whether history will repeat itself. Why was it important to give this character such a strong connection to a relative she never got to meet?
It's hard to answer that kind of because I started the story with the reincarnation. That was the thing that I was interested in first. So, which is why I say it's hard because it's a decision I didn't make because that's where I started. I started with what would it be like if you were, a young, just trying to figure out, like, with all life's complications, just trying to figure out life. But also being burdened with a whole other life and the legacy and choices that came from that whole other life. And I think in my first sort of attempt, it was meant to be like a weird coming of age story almost. And then later on, when I took another stab at it, it became this more of a family saga. But initially, it was supposed to be about this young woman and her trying to determine self, her journey to self-determination, and to wrenching herself from these expectations that were being placed on her. And I think even if your family doesn't think you're a reincarnation, a lot of people might be able to empathize with just familial pressure and familial expectation and, what that can feel like and how heavy a mantle that can sometimes be.
I want to try to ask this question without giving anything away, but I also, I want to ask how you crafted your prologue and epilogue. We expect a prologue to direct readers into a text and an epilogue to help readers reflect on the completed text, and these do that beautifully. But they also speak to each other in such a profound way. The epilogue feels like a retelling of the prologue with a new perspective that we really earn through reading the rest of the novel and growing with the characters. At what stage in writing this story did you know it needed this framing? And what would you say to readers, because unfortunately they exist, who skip prologues and epilogues?
I did not know there were skippers of pro. This is, I'm, no. I'm learning this. I don't know how to feel about this. Gosh, I didn't. Yeah, okay. First of all, don't do that. Like, what? There's a reason. There's a reason the prologue is there. But yeah, I think I don't remember when I did the prologue. I feel like I either did it first, or I did it very early on, the prologue, and then at some point I was like, right, I don't think I need the prologue, because sometimes, the way you start the story isn't the way you're gonna start the story eventually, so I think I wrote it to for a way in, and then at some point it was kind of like I had a similar experience with my sister's serial killer, actually, where the beginning was fine. I started with that in like the first draft and I stayed with that. But the subject headers were placeholders for me. And at some point in the editing process, I told my editors, right, I don't need the chapter titles anymore. We can do away with them. And then they were like, why? Like, they're perfectly fine. So we kept them in. But I had written those chapter titles to ground myself. Not because I thought they were going to be part of the finished product. It was a similar thing with this prologue where I just did it to, as a way into the story. And then at some point, I was like, I don't feel like I need it anymore. Now I'm in the story, I know what's going on. So I took it out and it just didn't feel right. So then I put it back in. And then at that point, I was like, okay, well, now I'm going to need an epilogue because it'd be weird to start like that. And then once I had the epilogue, it felt it's one of those things that after the fact people think you've done it intentionally, you always had that in mind, and it just wasn't like that. But once I had the epilogue down, it felt right and it fits so perfectly, well, from where I was standing anyway.
Do you want to talk about the dog?
Yes, Shango. What do you want me to say about him? Anything particular?
Well, I loved the idea of Shango the Immortal. He was this figure of ultimate loyalty and care, even if some of his family didn't understand him. How did you decide to give Monifei and Niyi Shango?
I think initially I was just looking for an excuse to have a dog in the story. Partly that. And then to be honest, I was more interested in it makes sense that you're asking about Monifa and Eni, but I was actually more interested in Ebun's relationship with Shango because to her, he's like this really annoying gothic creature that's just watching her all the time. And, there's just this presence that's like lurking in the corners and like is eyeing her and is like tailing this baby. So it was that idea first. And then you figure out what is this presence, and obviously he's not this, well, I guess there are some like somewhat supernatural aspects to him in the end, but he's also just a pet who really loved his mistress and his mistress 2.0 as well. But yeah, so that's kind of how Shango came about. But yeah, I really kind of enjoyed having him around.
We last spoke in 2018, 7 years ago, for my sister, the serial killer.
Crazy.
You wrote, "Cursed Daughters is a very different book from My Sister, the Serial Killer, and not just because of the content, but because it feels like I am a completely different person from the one who wrote my first novel." How so?
When I wrote My Sister Serial Killer, I was living with my parents, and I was in my late 20s and I had no responsibilities really, except, this strong desire to write and to get my work out there. But, since then a lot has happened. Obviously, My Sister Serial Killer came out and, did quite well. So I was no longer the girl who was hoping to just be published. I had basically accomplished my dream and in a way that I hadn't dreamt or imagined. And in 2023, when I started writing this, I was married, I was pregnant. My dad was staying with my husband and I, and he was dealing with a health diagnosis. There was also a lot going on emotionally for me at the time, and I had, like, the first 6 months of my pregnancy, I sort of dealt with hyperemesis gravidarum, which basically means I was throwing up like constantly round the clock. I couldn't keep anything down, lost a lot of weight, so I was in a very different space than I had been when I wrote My Sister Serial Killer. And so I suppose that's what I meant. I was not the Oiko of the before times, but everything that happens, it makes you who you are. And I'm more confident now than I was in 2018. I was giddy like throughout that time, but it was also scary in some ways. And I'm not as scared now. I kind of feel like, whatever comes, I'll handle it. And it's the same thing with this book. I don't know if it'll do anywhere near as well as My Sister the Serial Killer, but I've done my best, and that's all any of us can do.
When we spoke in 2018, I thought it was interesting how you said the sisters in My Sister, the Serial Killer, were two sides of the same coin. And Monifa and Aniyi also feel like two sides of the same coin, or actually maybe they're more of the same side of different coins.
Yeah.
Either way, in these two novels, you write about young women who share a very intense bond. Did you intend to write about close female relationships, or is that just coincidence?
It's just happening. I want to get away from it as quickly as possible before people decide that's my thing. I feel like it's already happening. They're like, "Oh, you write women relationships." It's not intentional. I don't know how I found myself here again. I thought I was getting as far away from My Sister the Serial Killer as possible. Turns out, I might have just done a loop. But yeah, I mean, it's women's relationships. If I'm gonna do relationships that aren't romantic, because there's so much to play around with romantic relationships, I think, women relationships to me are a lot more interesting than male relationships. Like when I listen to my husband and his friends talk, they're talking about the movie they recently watched or the game. But if you listen in on a conversation between, close women. They're talking about how heavy their period was, how pissed off their husbands made them, how, they're about to have this fibroid surgery. Like, it's very intimate details about their lives that are being shared. And because the love is so potent and intimate, when things go wrong, they go wrong in a, two males can maybe go an entire, like, and not fight or not, or be best friends and not even know they're best friends. But when two women clash, it's blown out of like all proportions. It's crazy. So I think it's an easy sort of area to dip into if you want to write weird stuff, I think.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
I don't know. I think if there is someone who's kind of confused about who he or she is and is encouraged to discover what a path for themselves might look like, if it comes about from reading this story, I think that would make me quite happy. But I don't usually write with like that kind of goal. That would be terrifying to be like, I'm gonna change people's lives. I don't know. But it would be good if it did encourage someone to seek out what they might want for themselves.
Well, the book is Cursed Daughters. Oyinka Braithwaite, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Cursed Daughters by Oyinka Braithwaite was published by Doubleday. Up next, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a new novel that digs into the mysteries of art, science, and memory. Aja Gabel's 2018 debut novel, The Ensemble, chronicled four young orchestra performers navigating the cutthroat world of classical music. Her new novel returns to the realm of fine arts, but this time fuses art and science in a fantastical story that explores time travel and the mysteries of the universe. Lightbreakers opens with a young couple who find each other in the wake of devastating loss. Noah is a quantum physicist obsessed with the secrets of time and consciousness. Maya is a visual artist focused on the nature of beauty and the here and now. They're happy newlyweds for the most part, but the relationship is haunted by Serena, the toddler daughter that Noah lost during his previous marriage with a fellow scientist. When an eccentric billionaire invites Noah to take part in a secretive experiment in the West Texas town of Marfa, he jumps at the chance. Maya goes along willingly and even excitedly, thinking this escape might be just what the couple needs to get away and start a family of their own. But things begin to unravel when they learn that the so-called Janus Project involves experiments on human consciousness that allow subjects to re-experience memories through folds in time. Noah is drawn to the experiment because he desperately wants to see his daughter again. As the project gets more complex and the experiments ever riskier, it stirs up complicated emotions for both Noah and Maya, and they struggle to find ways to communicate openly and honestly. Maya and Noah's marriage is characterized by their distinct perspectives as artist and scientist. Gable's beautiful writing explores that intersection along with the painful experience of losing a child. Lightbreakers explores a wide range of topics, ranging from environmental concerns to deep personal loss. And Gable's writing presents them all as worthy questions to ponder. How accurate is memory? Can we ever truly revisit the past? And how do we maintain human connections amid a world of ever-changing technology? A lot to think about in a novel to treasure. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez. Lightbreakers by Aja Gabel was published by Riverhead Books. And now joining us is Andrew Preston. He is the events coordinator at Coffee Tree Books in Moorhead, Kentucky, and he's bringing some book recommendations to us today. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about some books. I like to read a lot of different things, and I think it's cool to talk to people with different tastes than I do. So I'll start with some of my personal favorites. And a lot of these are sort of small press literary fiction. I really love weird, artistic, experimental kind of literature. And I absolutely fell in love with, and so far, this is, I think, my favorite book of the year. It's North Sun by Ethan Rutherford. And North Sun is sort of this like classic nautical Moby Dick kind of tale about a man who has been hired to sail across the ocean on this expedition to find a missing husband of a wealthy socialite. And on the way, it like degrades into this surrealist hellscape on the boat, and just weird things happen. It's impressionistic. It's like one long poem. It's just gorgeously written. You can pick out like any line from the book, and oh my God, it is just gorgeous. It's mysterious. It's just packed with beautiful imagery. It's haunting. It's spooky, and it has a wonderful twist. My favorite part about it is Ethan Rutherford, the author, has an accompanying soundtrack. It's like a noise art soundtrack that he has available on Bandcamp, and it's listed in the book so that you can go find a link to it and listen to it as you read. And it really does sound like how the book reads. It's just a brilliant package. On a similar note, Black Brain by Michael Sisko is another one that I really loved. Black Brain is sort of you could call it horror. It's the story of a man who's bedridden from some sort of illness or disaster. It's not quite clear at first what's actually happened, but he's hospitalized, he's bedridden, he can't move, he's in a lot of pain. So at the beginning of the book, you're hearing his memories that he's sort of self-soothing by talking about to himself. And he is talking about his time spent in a research facility that researches holes. And holes are different than cavities in this book. It's very clear that a cavity is like a cave. A cavity is a surface with an indention, no matter how deep the indention is. But the hole is itself the absence of space. And it's very important that the difference between a cavity and a hole is in this story. And so, as he's studying these holes with these like prominent researchers in this really niche scientific field, they sort of break open metaphysics and strange things start to happen, and you find out what's landed him in the hospital. And there are elements in the writing themselves that go along with this like falling apart metaphysical narrative. There are moments when I'm thinking I'm reading a typo and I'm wondering, how did this typo get in? And then I realize, oh, I think this is part of the story, and then it'll blow your mind. It's brilliantly done, and it's a really quick read too, but it's packed full of really cool stuff. One more book I want to talk about. It's a book of lyrics. It's called The Hum of a Dreaming Moon by A.P. Harbor. It's an illustrated lyric book. It's 120 songs presented as poetry. They're sort of abstract. They're sort of surrealist. And A.P. Harbor is a band, and the female lead vocalist of the band illustrated many of the songs in these like tattooy doodles. And so you can follow along with the songs, you can listen to the songs, you can look at the doodles, and it sort of captures that like surrealist whimsy of the music and the writing. And there's also notes in there that are presented sort of like an old record, and the liner notes of an old record are in there, and it's about the entire discography of the band and all the people that worked with them in the band, their process and all that sort of thing. So it's an awesome lyric book that can also just be a book of poetry. It's a nice book of poetry. Those are the things I've been reading lately that I've really enjoyed.
Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew recommended more books than we had time for, and you can listen to the rest of his recommendations at kmuw.org. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen, Katie Lanning, and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.